Coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. A University of Delaware study finds depictions of fatherhood in children's books have remained stagnant for decades.
It continues to send a message that fathers don't really have a really big role to play in the development of children, which is incredibly harmful.
We talked to one of the study's authors to examine how dads are portrayed to kids. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also learn more about how Rehoboth Beach grew into an attraction for queer residents and tourists. Art's Playlist spotlights the Delaware Art Museum's new exhibit of works by local artists. And History Matters examines the life and legacy of Delaware-born slave-turned-abolitionist Absalom Jones. It's all next on The Green, where Delaware gets tuned into a first state of mind. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Children's literature has always held a mirror on society. As social norms change and culture evolves, so too do the themes and characters in kids' books. And yet the role of the father figure, while pivotal, has largely remained stagnant and underexplored. That's according to a new study out of the University of Delaware, which examined depictions of fatherhood in nearly 40 award-winning children's books over the last two decades. And with Father's Day this weekend, Delaware Public Media's Kyle McKinnon sat down with the study's co-author, Bill Lewis, a professor in UD's School of Education, to learn more about his findings and the evolution of father figures in children's literature.
With Father's Day nearly here, there's no better time to talk about this study that you and Laura Cutler did. But Bill, where did this idea come from, you know, for the study? Why did you both decide to take a look at how fatherhood is portrayed and not just American children's literature, but Caldecott medal-winning children's lit?
I think that really where this research had its genesis was in the work that Laura Cutler was doing, particularly with her advisor, Dr. Rob Palkovich, from the college, who had recently retired. They were really looking at the changing roles of fathers and thinking about the ways that fatherhood is actually, you know, kind of represented in media. I teach young adult literature at the University of Delaware, and I'm also really concerned about representation, and particularly the narrow representation that we oftentimes see of a variety of different characters in these books. And so, you know, when we started thinking really hard about fathers, we wanted to think about, you know, what roles are fathers playing? Where do we see them in these spaces in children's books? And really recognizing that it's important to consider these pieces because, you know, I think as fathers, I'm a father myself. I'm also a grandfather of two grandchildren. So I've been thinking really hard about it just as a personal question. But the fatherhood expectations have changed, right, over the last couple of decades. And we really wanted to see whether or not those representations of fatherhood are actually reflecting those particular, you know, changing expectations that we see. Unfortunately, what we found is that those representations have remained relatively stagnant over the last couple of decades, which is, which I think is actually a real challenge, right? As we start thinking about it, as a young adult, as a teacher of young adult literature, and a believer in the important power that literature can play, and the formative aspects of really engaging kids of all ages with literature. If we have continuing narrow representations, it can actually really be harmful to kids' understanding of the roles that they can play in society. And it continues to send a message that fathers don't really have a really big role to play in the development of children, which is incredibly harmful.
Right. And there's a number of things that I want to unpack with you.
Sure.
Just for our listeners out there, Caldecott medal winning books have around the gold, silver, or bronze embellishment on the cover. It's an award doled out by the Association of Library Service for Children for the most distinguished American picture book for children. Your sample size consisted of 38 Caldecott medal-winning children's books from 2001 to 2020.
Yep.
So I am curious, what's the magic in those metrics? How did you land on examining nearly 40 award-winning books over the span of these two decades in particular?
Yeah, so actually, in our original research, we had originally identified over 80 books in there. Unfortunately, one of the things that we did is that for the inclusion in this study, we wanted to make sure that these picture books, of course, included a father. Unfortunately, less than half of the books that we identified as the Caldecott either winning books or honor books, is that less than half of those actually included an identifiable father figure at all. So, you know, when we start thinking about the roles that fatherhood plays and the representations of fatherhood in these books, it is actually a little bit concerning, right? When half of the books don't actually have a recognizable father at all, right? And that when we even look at the books later on, we see a little bit less. But it's really important to look. We wanted to look at some of the most recent decades of those books and to make some comparisons as we see sort of changes over time from 2001 until 2020. And that's when we were kind of finishing that up. So we wanted to have like a good solid two decades that we can work with to not only give us a higher number of picture books that we can examine, but also to see whether or not those representations were changing over time. I think that we can say in the last 20 years that there's been a lot of work in thinking through how important fatherhood is and trying to impress upon men how important their role is in their child care, in their child's development. You know, we see it in like, you know, Dance with a Dad, and we see it with all these other kinds of pushes to get fathers more involved. We wanted to see whether or not that was going to be actually evidenced in, you know, these award-winning books, which are basically, you know, there's a big economic factor with that Caldecott Award, right? Like, they're very popular books. They're the ones that are also identified by librarians as one that they want to purchase. Those are the ones that go into schools. And so, you know, thinking about those books and the influence that they have on children's literature as a whole is really important. So that's why we're really focusing on the Caldecott Honors. We wanted to focus on those two decades of books so we can compare those the most recent decade with the past decade, and to give ourselves also a few more books that we can actually evaluate as well.
You know, Bill, as the world continued to turn over these past two decades, and as the expectations, as you mentioned, the responsibilities and the general role of the dad in our society has evolved, again, you found that the representation of father and fatherhood in children's literature just hasn't really changed that much. And that's in both who fathers are and what fathers do. That's basically their entire identity, to say the least.
Yeah.
Can you walk us through then what exactly you found from representation to, again, their roles?
Yeah. So Laura and I found, you know, that a number of like, I think really important and I think really concerning trends. So first of all, we don't see fathers very much in a teaching role or in a childcare role, right? We oftentimes see them as recreational companions who are outside doing adventurous things with kids, right? And this sort of reinforces this pattern that we've seen in the literature where other researchers have looked at honor books, and basically they see a really, you know, they see a really constrained role for fathers as well, right? Fathers are companions, but they are oftentimes not feeding their children. They're not putting their children to bed. They're not engaging in these like hands-on childcare activities. I think in our study, Laura and I found that less than 25% of the fathers that were readily identifiable in those books are shown feeding their kids or putting their kids to bed. And oftentimes the places that we see fathers are still, you know, fairly limited. They're oftentimes outside the home in these outdoor locations that are indicative of sort of adventure or going on an excursion with kids. But again, we don't see that kind of home yard in the home, you know, hands-on childcare with fathers. We also saw that was also, I think, really concerning was that the demographic representation of fathers was not super diverse, right? Like, most fathers were white, were presented in heterosexual relationships, and that also were like kind of in a like presenting as traditionally masculine. We saw no queer fathers in any of the books that we sampled, right? Even though we see an increasing amount of families with two moms or two dads, we didn't see any of that in our representation of fathers. And generally speaking, we did see some minority fathers, but those representations are also constrained, right? Oftentimes, if we see kind of Black fathers, they're oftentimes represented in this sort of struggle for civil rights or this struggle for like freedom box representation, right? So we don't see like a lot of representations of like, hey, here's a Black father who's just going to the park with their kid, right? It's oftentimes this sort of single story about struggle against oppression. And hey, those books are really important, right? We need those books, but we also would love to see representations of minority fathers in a variety of different spaces, not always in this struggle against, of social ills. We also saw the same thing from immigrant groups. It's a struggle and strife kind of representation. And again, like I said, these are important pieces. They represent an important truth about the experience of people and families in our society. At the same time, they get into that trouble of presenting a single story about a particular group. And we need to make sure that we see many stories about these groups, not just that single story.
What changes this dynamic in this portrayal? And I know you also mentioned the economic side of things and the publisher side of things, but what changes this kind of dynamic?
Yeah, that's a great question, Kyle. I think, we really focus in the, Laura and I really focus in this piece on the publishing industry. The publishing industry is going to be, if they're rewarding particular kinds of stories and they're not rewarding other kinds of stories, people are going to write the kinds of stories that get rewarded. Right. And that means that they get published and they get distributed and they get the advertising and they get the awards. That's we're hoping that the publishing industry is going to sort of take up the mantle of responsibility to get more diverse voices and diverse representations out there in the public. And until that really changes, until those the publishing industry starts to recognize those, I don't think that we're really going to get any substantive changes, right? We're going to continue to get these more traditional representations. So that's the first thing. I also think that teachers also can play a role in this too. So I'm a I do work with pre-service teachers, and one of the things that I think that we need to be advocates for is for diverse representation in the books that we're going to be choosing in our classroom, right? So we have, I think we still have a certain amount of freedom to choose the particular kinds of books that we want to show. So if teachers are thinking thoughtfully, are being thoughtful about those representations and are kind of understanding that the publishing industry does have a particular bias towards particular kinds of stories, like we need to, I think, fight against that bias and put pressure on publishing companies to expand the types of books that we see multiple representations of diverse fathers and mothers and families.
Thanks to UD Professor Bill Lewis and our Kyle McKinnon for joining us on The Green this week. And happy Father's Day to all the dads listening. And stay with us, we meet the author of the new book, Queering Rehoboth Beach, Beyond the Boardwalk, to discuss how Rehoboth grew into an attraction for queer residents and tourists. That's next on The Green, here on Delaware Public Media. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. And I'm Tom Byrne. Delaware trails only Hawaii as the state with the highest number of gay and lesbian households per capita. And much of that number is thanks to Rehoboth Beach, which is ranked as the fourth small city in the country for same-sex couples. This week, Delaware Public Media's Rachel Sawicki caught up with historian and author James Sears to discuss his new book, Queering Rehoboth Beach, Beyond the Boardwalk, which chronicles how a town with Methodist roots transformed into an attraction for queer residents and tourists.
You've written about 300 pages about how Rehoboth Beach transformed from a small, conservative southern town to now the fourth-ranked small city in the nation for same-sex couples. Can you give me a quick summary of how that happened?
Well, first, I'm very happy to be here with you, Rachel. Briefly, the queering of Rehoboth was something that most visibly happened from the beginning in the mid-1970s, but it could not have happened had, for example, other events taking place, for example, the building of the Chesapeake Bridge. That allowed many visitors, gay and straight, to come to Rehoboth from the mid-1950s onward. And that includes, a lot of people from Washington who were queer. So Rehoboth has always been had a gay presence, but it became more visible by the mid to late 1970s. And oddly, in some ways, it first occurred through the businesses, through restaurants. And most notable beginning was the Back Porch Cafe, and that was opened by three people, two a heterosexual couple and a gay man. And then by 1980, another restaurant opened, which was not gay but was gay friendly, and that was called the Chez La Mer, and that was actually opened by Nancy Rolfe, who was actually used to work in Washington. And in 1981, the gay man Victor Passapia joined with Joyce Felton, who was a very interesting Brooklyner, and they opened the Blue Moon. And the Blue Moon became really the first visible presence that if you were non-gay, if you were driving down Baltimore Avenue in the early 1980s, you would see all these gay, primarily, white gay men out there. And it would be quite obvious. And in fact, during that period of time in the early 80s, mid-80s, it was not unusual, for example, for youngsters to be driving by in their cars and then tossing beer bottles or eggs or whatever. So that was the beginning of the queering of Rehoboth. Now, there are other events that took place afterward, but I can get into those later on or now.
Yes, let's definitely get into that, because I noticed that as I was reading that a lot of these events had to do with restaurants and nightclubs in the area and the battle these business owners had with various mayors, commissioners, and the homeowners association even over the years. But my question is, why would so many gay people come from these big cities where it was maybe easier to be out to Rehoboth Beach, where your local leadership was so vehemently against that population being there?
Well, a couple of things. Rehoboth did not have any ostensibly gay bars or nightclubs until the first one was the Strand in that started in late 1988, 1989. Before that time, all the bars and nightclubs, dance clubs were outside the city limits. And the most noteworthy one occurred a year before the Blue Moon opened, and that was with Glenn Thompson's The Renegade. Now, Thompson was a bar impresario, a gay man, had many bars in Washington, D.C., okay, gay bars. And so he opened that. And so that, between that and the Blue Moon, that brought, for example, the Washington Blade began to write stories about Rehoboth Beach. And so if you were a gay man, particularly if you're a male, and you traveled here, the opportunities to engage, in dancing, to have good food, to go down to the Poodle Beach, which had just the gay people have just settled beforehand, they would go to all the way down to Carpenter's Beach, which would be about maybe about a quarter mile from Poodle's Beach. By going all the way down there in the 1960s and 19 most of the, and all the 1970s, they were way out of people's visibility. So by the 1980s, again, that presence, that queer presence began to be shown at Poodle Beach. So by 1980s, you had the restaurants, you had the Renegade, and you had Poodle Beach. Why? Well, a couple of reasons. One is beforehand, a lot of gay people, particularly like in the East Coast cities, Philadelphia, Baltimore, before that time, gay men and lesbians would go to Atlantic City. Okay, and that was really the place. If you're going to go to the beach and you were queer, that's where you would go if you were in the mid-Atlantic. But Atlantic City changed significantly by around 1980. A couple of things were happening. One is there were issues dealing with pollution on the ocean. And then secondly, and probably more importantly, there was the beginnings of the building of casinos. And so then all the cheap rentals that were used for bars, et cetera, on New York Avenue, those rents went up. And things got torn down. And so basically, by the time that Atlantic City was dwindling in terms of queer tourists, Rehoboth Beach was ascending.
So you said something there that I want to touch on as well, is that gay men had a lot more opportunity to frequent these businesses, in a sense had more privilege than lesbians or transgender people. And you talk about it a bit in the book as well, that some of these more conservative gay men, they didn't want to bring attention to themselves. At one point, you even mentioned some of them had, quote, purist notions. So what was it that actually was the turning point for Rehoboth to become more of an out and proud environment?
Well, the most obvious turning point would have been sort of the dual issues of dealing with one, the Strand nightclub, which opened in 1989, and then shortly thereafter, the formation of CAMP, which was a queer organization founded by several gay men. And CAMP stands for Create a More Positive Rehoboth. Now, I should point out that the people, the homosexuals, I'm going to use that term, the homosexuals who were the old Rehoboth, part of the old Rehoboth, these are individuals, they could have been teachers, they could have been government workers, et cetera. They often bought houses when, back in the 19, early 70s, mid 70s, some of them bought houses in the 1960s. So they knew sort of the rules of decorum. So in other words, you were not open in terms of your affections, and you certainly, if you engaged in parties, most of the parties then at that period of time were like dinner parties, et cetera. And as I said before, at that time they would go all the way down to Carpenter's Beach. So the queer presence in Rehoboth, up through about 1980, was pretty invisible.
Right. Well, even today, it's not 100%. I mean, the prologue is a personal anecdote from you and a not so friendly encounter you had in recent years. What can you tell me about your own experience living in Rehoboth today?
So we came to Rehoboth around 2000 and fall of 2019. And but as the book sort of chronicles, I think, in great detail, Rehoboth was quite clear in terms of where its city limits lay. And it was certainly not going to be part of West Rehoboth. And we lived in that area. But we lived there for a number of years, and that gave me the opportunity, and my husband, Luis, the opportunity to spend a lot of time in Rehoboth. And like many gay couples, I mean, we found, and lesbian couples, we found Rehoboth inviting, gay flags everywhere. They had Letters, which was a publication, biweekly publication of CAMP. You had Rehoboth Beach. By then, you had many other kinds of bars, and it was a genuine openness. And so, because of that, I guess I naively thought that, and I shouldn't have because I'm old enough to know better, but that small marks of affection were things that would be accepted, even in restaurants. And what I didn't realize at the time was that we went to one restaurant which was not particularly gay friendly to begin with, and then that created an issue with some of the diners who were sitting next to us. But the reason that story is important, I think, is two reasons. One, I began to question, well, is what I see actually what's there, or is there sort of what you see is on the surface, and then there's other things going below? And the other question, probably more important question, was just like you asked at the beginning, how did Rehoboth become so queer? And as I was reading through letters, stuff, I found anecdotal stories, but there was nothing that really told the story. And so that's when I decided to embark on that. And the other thing I think is important to understand is, although the title is Queering and Rehoboth Beach, it's neither simply about queers, nor is it simply about Rehoboth Beach. And by that, I mean, you can read a lot about Rehoboth Beach, which has nothing ostensibly to do with homosexuals, lesbians, gay men, transvestites, quote unquote. And the reason is, to understand any town, I believe, you have to understand the entire town. You just can't understand the little aspect that you're looking at.
Yeah, and that history of the town's Methodist roots, for me at least, really did explain some of those struggles that gay people in Rehoboth faced along the way as more of the LGBTQ community started to show up and get louder. To wrap up, I wanted to ask if there was anything in your research that surprised you that maybe you didn't realize about Rehoboth or anything that you were not anticipating as you were writing the book.
Well, two of those that surprised me, I've already mentioned. Okay, one is the vitriolic response over many years to the Strand. And then the second was these parallels between the 1980s and the 1880s. The other thing, though, I think that is important is that I really didn't appreciate, although I certainly understand, didn't really appreciate that although we were talking about queering Rehoboth, we're talking about the Blue Moon and all these things, all these restaurants, et cetera, they primarily catered to a particular group of queers, mainly white gay men. And you have this interesting combination here that on one hand, you have the story of the town becoming more open with respect to homosexuality, but certainly no less open to people of color, and certainly no less open to trans people. And that's the town and that's the camp, both of them during that time. Camp's philosophy, which I think was reflective of like the philosophy of Clinton, let's go out and try to work in this toward the center, try to find common ground in the center. That was a very powerful approach. In doing that, and being a white gay male who was organizing those people, there were many values in common that they had with the homeowner association. And the best example of that is the closing of the lesbian shop, okay, which in the back they sold very discreetly sexual paraphernalia, okay, for women and men. That was reported by two gay men to the city government. Bottom line is that the shop was closed and the women were arrested. Now, interestingly, when the camp's position on that was, if it's illegal, then we're not going to support it. And that what we're about is a family town. And what is a family town? The family town doesn't have places where you can buy X-rated materials. One set of materials that I looked at, I'm the first person to ever see them, is the Rehoboth Beach board minutes. And in those board minutes, it's quite clear that was a turning point. Because all of a sudden, then the leaders, who were many of them were certainly anti-gay, saw that in fact there was a commonality there. Okay, that they didn't want that the queers didn't want to take over the town. They're more like us, okay, than we thought. And then that's in fact when they began to invite some people, including one of the leaders of camp, Steve Elkins, to join the board. So those are the things that I found that I thought was most interesting, and also the things that I did not anticipate.
Thanks to author and historian James Sears and our Rachel Sawicki for taking time to join us on The Green this week. Up next, Arts Playlist, where we head to the Delaware Art Museum for a preview of their latest exhibition featuring an eclectic collection of works by local artists. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. The Delaware Art Museum recently unveiled its latest exhibition, Paintings from the Collection, showcasing diverse abstract works, landscapes, and eclectic styles. The collection is comprised of pieces from local artists, including a number of acquisitions from other exhibits and gifts from museum donors. In this edition of Arts Playlist, Delaware Public Media's Carl Lengo is joined by Delaware Art Museum head curator Margaret Winslow for more on Paintings from the Collection.
Paintings from the Collection, it's a wide array of art and diverse works from various sources. How did the collection come together?
That's a great question, Carl. This exhibition, Paintings from the Collection, draws primarily on the museum's contemporary painting collection. And in across two galleries, we're focusing on landscapes, portraits, abstraction, figuration, works of art primarily from the 1960s through today. And they come into the collection like many other works of art in the Delaware Art Museum's holdings, a range of generous gifts from our supporters over the years, as well as museum purchases. So additions that are coming in that manner.
It's a pretty wide range of artists, I'm guessing.
Absolutely. So these are names who are well familiar to the greater Delaware art community. Artists like Rebecca Raubacher, Ken Mabry, Roberta Tucci, as well as artists who extend outside of the greater Delaware region. Lisa Bradley, Felrith Hines, Simi Knox, an artist who has a long history associated with this area and is based down in Washington, D.C. And as I said, because it's so diverse intentionally, the hope is that visitors will be able to see just how wide a range and variety there is in painting of the last several decades.
You have any favorites?
Oh, that is such a great question, Carl. Always hard to pick a favorite. I am thrilled that we are able to present several new acquisitions to the museum's contemporary painting collection. So you'll see in these exhibitions some museum favorites, paintings that have been in the collection almost since the time they were made. So paintings from the 1980s that came in the 1980s or the 90s or 2000s, In addition, there are recent acquisitions that we have not yet had on view. So a stunning composition by Simi Knox, the first of the artist's work to come into our collection, a recent acquisition that we've been holding for this exhibition, the opportunity to present it to the first for the first time to our visitors. Also a fabulous painting by Rebecca Raubacher, who has an exhibition down at the Bix Museum of American Art currently. A new acquisition, again, on view for the first time in this show.
A lot of exhibitions you work either from an artist or from an era. This one, you kind of just open the door and go, it seems like that would be very challenging as a curator to pull that together. Or, I mean, how do you approach that?
It's a wonderful opportunity. I was going to say challenge, and it's a little bit of that too, but really it was a wonderful challenge and a wonderful opportunity to look broadly at 40 years of contemporary painting, to start pulling the threads of those trends that I'm seeing across the collection among the works. How are artists exploring the still life in somewhat similar ways, whether it's compositionally, whether it's in regards to the way they are executing and laying down the imagery on the canvas itself. How are artists portraying people in particular settings, in nuanced ways, in layered compositions, and similar questions to the landscape, to abstraction? What are some of those formal elements that bring various modes of abstraction together? So taking as wide a lens as possible and then pulling together those similar conversations. And that's the hope when visitors go into the spaces, that they will be engaged in that conversation, seeing the diversity, seeing the similarities, considering how artists have worked in painting.
Conversations, that seems to work well with complementary, which is a word used to describe this particular exhibit. What is it exactly do you mean by complementary? How does it complement the other surrounding exhibits, for example?
Well, I think it's a great opportunity for visitors to be immersed in a particular mode of creativity across these two spaces. We have two exhibition spaces dedicated to these exhibitions. And then, of course, go back into the museum's permanent collection, because this is an extension of it. So how does this deeper dive into contemporary painting set them up, offer questions, offer new perspectives for the rest of the museum's collection? And I say that going into the Pre-Raphaelite collection, for example, or looking at Howard Pyle's impressive narrative paintings in the American Illustration Collection.
Museum is also showing its photography from the collection exhibit. Now, in terms of preparation, how does the planning process and those considerations vary from something like paintings from the collection?
That's a wonderful question, Carl. What we aim to do across the exhibition schedule is provide a diverse range of exhibitions that complement the museum's core collections. And so varying the schedule with paintings from the collection, with a photography exhibition, the Delaware Art Museum has deep and rich holdings in photography, including an immersive installation by Dennis Beach, Suspended Spins, that's on view in the museum's East Court, so that when a visitor comes to the museum, they have so many different modes from which to choose and by which to be inspired. So really creating that diverse experience for all of our museum visitors.
So let's get them in the door for all of this activity. Let's talk a little bit more just about the timeline for paintings from the collection. How long do we have here?
Well, It's really quite wonderful. We've been able to have this focus, we'll be able to have this focus on contemporary paintings from the collection from the summer all the way into early next year. So as I mentioned, they're across two galleries. In Gallery 9, that exhibition just opened this past weekend on June 8th. That runs through February 9th of next year. In Galleries 11 and 12 upstairs, that exhibition, that portion of the exhibition, opens on July 13th and is on view through January 5th.
And anything else you want to tell us about the summer before we have to run away here?
Well, I encourage our listeners to visit delart.org, follow us on social media. Our weekly happy hours on Thursday evenings offer a layered creative experience here at the museum. The galleries are open, free to the public. We have live music outside on the museum terrace. Often there's layered programming to complement the evening. It's a great opportunity to come in and experience all the Delaware Art Museum has to offer.
Thanks to the Delaware Art Museum's head curator, Margaret Winslow, and our Carl Engel for joining us on this edition of Arts Playlist. And we wrap up the Green next with History Matters and a closer look at the life and legacy of Delaware-born slave turned abolitionist Absalom Jones. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. Despite not being as well known as other leaders of his time, Absalom Jones's legacy is still felt today. Born into slavery in 18th century Delaware at a time when history was being debated as immoral and undemocratic, Jones would go on to become America's first black Episcopal priest and founder of both the first black Episcopal congregation and the first free African society. In this edition of History Matters, Delaware Public Media's Kyle McKinnon sits down with Philadelphia-based writer and educator Amy Jane Cohen for a closer look at Jones's life and lasting influence ahead of Juneteenth.
Can you give us a snapshot of who Absalom Jones was and his significance in the conversation we're having today?
As you mentioned, Kyle, Absalom Jones was born in Delaware, but when he was fairly young man, the man who enslaved him sold his mother and I believe a brother to someone else, kept Absalom, and moved with him to Philadelphia. Absalom Jones, when he was in Philadelphia, was able to attend the Benezet School run by abolitionist Anthony Benezet. So he learned how to read and write. He was able to raise some funds by working for others, and he bought his wife out of slavery. Of course, he was more concerned about his wife's status because the status of a child would follow the status of a mother, and eventually bought himself out of slavery. He befriended Richard Allen, another great religious leader with some Delaware ties, and together they were lay preachers at St. George's Church in the Old City section of Philadelphia. The black community would worship at the church until one day they were told that they needed to move to different seats. And Absalom Jones and Richard Allen then led a walkout and never went back to St. George's. They formed something called the Free African Society that eventually led to Absalom Jones starting the African Episcopal Church of St. Thomas. The Free African Society was a mutual aid society, and he and Richard Allen were incredible leaders of this new building, blossoming free Black community that from about 1790 to about 1840 was thriving in Philadelphia. Not thriving without challenges. There were, of course, many challenges, but Philadelphia became the center of free Black life. Absalom Jones, along with Richard Allen, who were contemporaries of the founding fathers, they were both friends with Dr. Benjamin Rush, a signer of the Declaration of Independence. they really were founding fathers themselves of the Black community. And Absalom Jones Church continues today. Richard Allen, his partner in so many different things, founded Mother Bethel Church and also the African Methodist Episcopal denomination. And the Mother Bethel Church at 6 and Lombard is the land that has been continuously held by African Americans for more than any other piece of property in the entire country.
I'm glad you touched on a number of things there, because I'd say Absalom Jones really is inseparable from Richard Allen, at least it seems how we, you know, when we look back at history, who again, Richard Allen was also enslaved in Delaware, you know, and then they became lifelong friends and, like you said, founded the Free African Society, among many other things. But, you know, stepping back a bit, it feels like Absalom Jones is one of many Black leaders that gets somewhat lost in the translation of history. For yourself as an educator, as a historian, as a writer who just published Black History in the Philadelphia Landscape, Deep Roots, Continuing Legacy, how does this happen? How does someone with the significance of an Absalom Jones or of a Richard Allen get lost in the translation of history?
Well, that's an interesting question that raises some other issues that I want to discuss. But in terms of how their stories were sort of lost to history, they were Black men, and we live in a white supremacist society, and the general historical narrative of American history that most of us learned in school, if we're talking about, you know, the late 18th century, we're talking about Thomas Jefferson and George Washington and James Madison, and we're not mentioning that most of the signers of the Declaration of Independence, as well as you know, George Washington, owned enslaved people. That's a whole other topic, but people like Richard Allen and Absalom Jones fall to the wayside. Now, with a revived interest in Black history, I've also found that at this point, if I'm talking to people about, you know, 18th, early 19th century Philadelphia, two of the names that they will know will be Richard Allen and Absalom Jones, but they didn't act alone. So, you know, if you dig a little deeper, there's a whole nother layer of free Black leaders. Maybe they, you know, aren't the marquee names, maybe like Jones and Allen, who at this point in the city are represented in markers and murals, and their churches are still standing and so forth. But there are a whole lot of other people, you know, whose stories still do remain to be told.
All that being said, you know, Absalom Jones, just speaking to him in particular, you know, his achievements are still commemorated on three Pennsylvania state historical markers. Delaware's state historical marker honors him in Milford. He also has a striking oil painting portrait that really stands alone at the Delaware Art Museum. When it comes to your book, things like your book, or, you know, it's clear that the roots of Black history run deep in this region. How do we ensure this kind of education or awareness, this history, you know, how do we ensure this history continues on? Is it through conversations like this, the quality of our school curriculums, which is certainly is an ongoing issue in and of itself, but, you know, what does that equation look like in your view?
Yeah, and I just want to double back a little bit. You mentioned the Raphael Peel portrait of Absalom Jones,
yes.
And I'm a very visual person, and if folks haven't seen that image, they should just Google it. It's so striking because it's a classical portrait and he looks so elegant and distinguished, and it was so unusual for its time. It's actually, I mean, I had to limit to the number of images I could have in my book. That image is included. And as soon as you say Absalom Jones, I'm picturing that. And to me, that's just kind of the power of the visual. In terms of your other question, certainly I think a lot of it does have to do with curriculum. The danger we're in as a country is we already have kind of siloed and opposing news sources. If you're, you know, looking at cable news, you're seeing two different realities of what's going on today. Similarly, in schools in more progressive parts of the country, Black history really is being integrated much more into the curriculum. But then we have places like Florida, which famously are trying to all but eliminate talk of slavery and the history of white supremacy and, you know, this sort of whitewashed history that so many people my age and older were raised on. It is, again, becoming the reality for part of the country. So I feel like things are improving. I hear from more and more schools that are offering Black history courses. But again, those are, you know, certainly not in the Southern United States.
With Juneteenth on the horizon, I do want to touch on that briefly here. It's a day that honors how a little over 400 years ago in 1619, slavery officially began in America. Some say it marks more of a turning point, but we'll say it started with the sale of 20 humans in Virginia. And according to the Transatlantic Slave Trade Database, 12 and a half million Africans were shipped to the New World before slavery was abolished in 1865. But Amy, as we've said, in today's world where we see slavery and the Black experience being whittled down and redefined in certain state curriculums like Florida, how would you describe the meaning and significance of 1619 in, you know, this year, 2024?
Yeah, that's a good question. Well, I think one cannot understand American history without understanding the role of enslavement and the ongoing legacy of slavery. It simply can't be done because the country was literally built through slave labor. The wealth of the country was in large part the result of slave labor. As I mentioned earlier, the founding fathers who came up with the ideals of our country, to which we're still not fully living up, most of them were enslavers. It's just so fundamental to who we are as a nation that it just can't be separated. By thinking of 1619, it helps us to recognize three really significant things about the Black experience. One is that it is very long and deep in this country. Secondly, any progress that we've made has often been made because of Black people pushing the nation along. Thirdly, you know, as we know, slavery didn't just end abruptly. It turned and morphed into other things. It morphed into Jim Crow and it morphed into segregation, and that fed into redlining. And so that might be a long answer, but it's a really fundamental question about the American story.
Thanks to writer and educator Amy Jane Cohen and R. Kyle MacKinnon for showing us why history matters this week. And we've reached the finish line for this edition of The Green. The stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. You can also sign up for our weekly newsletter there by clicking Newsletters at the top of the page. And remember, The Green is also available via podcast at our website, as well as Apple Podcasts and the NPR and Delaware Public Media apps. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page or by emailing us at TheGreen@DelawarePublic.org. Thanks to all those who helped make this week's show possible, Delaware Public Media's Carl Lengel and Rachel Sawicki, and our senior producer, Kyle MacKinnon. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Bernsing. Thanks for joining us this week, and we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delawareans get tuned into a first state of mind.